The next speaker on the effect of nuclear attack on Nanus Bay is Dr. Dorothy Goreski, who received her BSc at the University of Saskatchewan and her MD in Alberta. After a country practice of 3.5 years in Saskatchewan, she served as a school physician in Burnaby for 5 years. Then she took time out to raise 4 children before returning to medical duties as the first woman in the student health service at UBC. Dr. Goreski participated on the original steering committee for Physicians for Social Responsibility, and in 1980 was the founding president of the BC chapter of that organization. She served on the board of directors of Physicians for Social Responsibility and has been its president since October of 1984. She was one of the 5 Canadian delegates to the 3rd Congress of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War held in the Netherlands in 1983, after which she visited the USSR, a 2-week tour arranged by Physicians for Social Responsibility with Soviet physicians. She's attended many PSR conferences around the world, and recently she was in Oslo for the Nobel Peace Prize award ceremonies. Dr. Goreski's particular interest is psychosomatic and psychological illness, and has led her to be concerned with the psychological effects of the nuclear threat. Dr. Dorothy Goreski.
I would like to join with others in congratulating all those who have put together this very fine inquiry and providing all the facilities that they have. When the request last night was made for parents to pick up their children, it reminded me of the comment that was made by the tour guide that I had when I was in the Soviet Union, and where she had been asked about the facilities for children, and she said that sometimes there were facilities for working parents to leave their children the entire week in care centers, and that a joke had gone around about the father arriving at the door on Friday evening with his child, and the mother saying, "But George, he isn't our child." And George said, "It's all right, we take him back on Monday morning anyway." Ultimate beauty, ultimate disaster. Such is the title of the Burning Butterflies poster by Kamakura, a Japanese graphic artist. Daily, we must touch beauty, such as butterflies, a symbol of the wonderful wide world surround us. Periodically, we must recall the horrors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, witnesses to the destructive power of nuclear weapons. We must combine these 2 segments of our awareness if we are to avoid destroying our planet. It is appropriate then that we expose ourselves once more to the pain of the cataclysmic effects of a nuclear weapon. Do we really comprehend that nuclear weapons are not just quantitatively, but also qualitatively different? What is a qualitative difference? A nuclear explosion releases power equivalent to millions of tons of TNT, with temperatures raising up to the millions of degrees. When we multiply anything by a million, we effectively change it altogether. Going down the street, we go at about 3 miles an hour. Multiply that by a million, and we are going fast enough to leave the planet. That is a qualitative difference. What happens to our environment with a nuclear explosion? In a nuclear explosion, about 35% of the energy is released as heat or thermal energy, 50% as blast, and 15% as radiation. Let us first look at the heat. The sun glows yellow because its surface temperature is about 5,500 degrees centigrade. Its interior is somewhere between 10 and 30 million degrees. A small nuclear explosion, such as the one that devastated Nagasaki, releases those tremendous amounts of energy and heat within a millisecond of detonation. The fireball that is formed quickly breaks into two concentric portions, a center inner hotter core and an outer cooler rapidly expanding outer region. The tremendous temperatures that are present are sufficient to melt sheet metal, glass, to cause vaporization of metals, and to cause spontaneous ignition of paper, of clothing, of leaves. These fires that are formed will coalesce into a huge conflagration that moves outwards from the center. As the fireball begins to cool, and with these fires moving away from the center, a low pressure area is formed, so there's a vacuum. There will be a moment of stillness, and then there's a total reversal of the fires and the winds, and everything is swept back into the center again. What is the nature of the blast, the 50% that is up here? Those high temperatures that I've mentioned vaporize materials to form extremely hot compressed gases. As these gases expand, they heat and push air molecules in front of them, forming a shock wave. This shock wave travels slower than the speed of, faster than the speed of sound, but slower than the thermal wave, which accounts for the fact that things catch fire. This shows one of these experimental buildings catching fire in the first frame before they are totally devastated by the tremendous winds and blasts that happen. The blast is composed of two parts. The one steady sustained pressure, which is called the static overpressure and is measured in pounds per square inch. And then the accompanying winds, which of course are measured in kilometers or in miles per hour. This chart shows you the varying pounds per square inch overpressure and the dynamic pressures, the winds, that are accompanying a blast, a 1 megaton blast, and the varying degrees, the varying radii beyond which those pressures are present. The measurement pound per square inch is a very deceptive measurement. 1 psi overpressure doesn't sound like very much. However, over a square foot, that equals 144 pounds, and over an average window, which is about 3 by 6 feet, that becomes a pressure of 2,600 pounds. As little as 0.5 to 1 psi will shatter glass and send it into millions of little pieces, which become deadly missiles when the accompanying winds. Within that center area, the 1.5 radius, with overpressures of 20 to 200 psi, absolutely everything is destroyed. And you will see on the right-hand side the accompanying dynamic overpressures, accompanying winds, out to a radius of 8.5 miles, they are 160 miles an hour, which is a hurricane force. As you see in the center areas, they reach up to 600 mph. What is radiation? Some elements are unstable, meaning their atoms spontaneously emit particles. This process is called radioactive decay, and the rate at which it happens is measured in terms called half-life. That is the length of time it takes for the radioactivity of an element to be reduced by half. The half-life of elements range from hours to millions of years. In a nuclear explosion, of the 15% of that energy that is released, in the first 2 minutes, only 5% of it is released. The remaining two-thirds is released over, one-third of that is released in the first 2 minutes. The remaining two-thirds of that radiation is released over that varying length of time. In this process of radioactive decay, the types of particles given off have very different characteristics. Some of them are quite large and can be stopped by paper and by dirt. So the civil defense planners who tell you that it's the dirt that counts are partially correct. What they don't tell you is about the properties of all the other parts of the elements that are emitted. They don't tell you, for instance, that some of them have much greater penetrating power, and for instance, that if food and water are contaminated and that you ingest them, that you run this greater risk. This is a diagrammatic form of the fallout plume that would happen if there were a burst over Vancouver, and as you can see, the fallout plume can reach as far away as Campbell River. What about the people? Those closest to the blast were simply vaporized. It's these pictures of their shadows on the concrete walls that stand out most vividly in my memory of the first times I ever saw pictures of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Further away, they became instantly crisped. This is a drawing made by a survivor of a mother and child who became an instant charcoal statue. Further away, it was as though they had been instantly baked, as this victim. John Hershey's book, Hiroshima, contains the vivid recounting of survivors as they came upon the dead and dying. And I quote, "I came upon I don't know how many, burned from the hips up. And where the skin had peeled, their flesh was wet and mushy. They must have been wearing their military caps, these soldiers, because the black hair on the top of their head was not burned. And they had no faces. Their eyes, noses, and mouths had been burned away, and it looked like their ears had melted off. It was hard to tell front from back." People who are burned may be burned and received first, second, or third degree burns. A first degree burn is what we receive from the sunburn, where our clothing protects us as it protected this man. These first degree burns can be received as far away as 7 miles from the hypocenter. Second degree burns consist of blistering. If they are extensive, they can be extremely painful and may be life-threatening. Third degree burns, there is carbonization of all layers of the skin, such as in this survivor. This can happen as far away as 5 miles from the hypocenter. The thermal energy alone that I spoke of, that 35%, and having nothing to do with the fires which may occur, the thermal energy alone can cause those injuries, those burns. What treatment is required? Massive quantities of body fluid are lost through the damaged skin, requiring huge amounts of intravenous fluids and blood. Without the protective skin, people are easy prey to infection, so they must receive antibiotics, be isolated away from infection. Radiation damages our immune system, so that even with antibiotics, they may not be successful in helping people recover. These people require 24-hour intensive care in special beds. Here I am again. That's the radius. I tried to draw a map of Nanus Bay and put the radii of the various distances at which the heat and the burns happen. This is not nearly as dramatic as it is when it's placed over a city. This is a burn bed. In all of North America, that's not just Canada, in all of North America, there are only some 2,000 burn beds. In addition to these local effects, any sighted animal, insect, or human as far as 35 miles from the blast, reflexly glancing at the fireball, could receive burns to the retina, causing permanent blindness. This is the picture of a retina of such a person. The human body, except for the eardrums and lungs, is quite resistant to overpressure. The eardrums, however, will be shattered by 5 pounds per square inch overpressure, and 20 to 30 will rupture the air sacs in the lung, releasing air into the bloodstream, which can go to the brain and cause instant death. The real damage to humans from the blast is from the accompanying winds. You can imagine that being picked up and hurled at these tremendous speeds until you strike against a solid object, being struck by flying glass and all the materials flying around will cause tremendous damage. The crushed chests, the broken arms and legs, the ruptured viscera, the incredible wounds that will happen, people cannot survive these sort of things. This is a picture of hemorrhaging that occurs into the skin. This is due more often to the radiation. This is a radiation effect. Beyond these immediate fatalities, there would be thousands of short and long-term delayed illnesses and deaths. Over the first 2 weeks, thousands would die of radiation sickness. These people would suffer from severe nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, disorientation, respiratory difficulty, seizures, dehydration, and death. And this hemorrhaging is a very frequent event. The problem of mass infection would be terrible. Decomposing bodies, contaminated water supplies, lack of food and sanitation, lack of any medical care, plagues of disease-bearing mosquitoes, flies, and insects, because they are more resistant to radiation, these would carry epidemics of diseases which are no longer present or occur very rarely. There would be epidemics of diarrhea, hepatitis, pneumonia, meningitis, tuberculosis. And the diseases that we think of no longer in our areas, cholera, typhoid, typhus, and malaria, would flourish in many areas. And as I've already indicated, without our immune system intact, even with best of care and antibiotics, we cannot combat them. Still longer-term effects of radiation would be loss of hair. This is a survivor who's lost her hair. An increased incidence of mental deficiency in children born to women who were pregnant at the time of the explosion. These are two children who suffer microcephaly and with mental retardation. There would be decreased fertility for a varying period of time because, again, the ovaries and the testes are much more susceptible to radiation. And in a still longer period of time, people suffer from the keloid scars. These are the excessive scar tissue that forms. And these are terribly disfiguring, disabling, and obviously the emotional disability that goes with them is tremendous and requires extreme long-term plastic surgery. The other long-term problems are those of leukemia and of cancers such as the thyroid, the breast, the lung. What are the possibilities of providing medical help to our survivors? Those going in to help the Japanese survivors had no understanding of what they faced, and they went in. There was an outside world to help. Physicians for Social Responsibility make one very clear statement. There is no possible medical response to a nuclear war. That is based on a diversity of facts, but the one incontrovertible one is the types of injuries that are received would require the most sophisticated hospitals, the most sophisticated medical equipment and medical supplies, the most skilled physicians and nursing teams would be required. From where, how, and with what would that help would arrive? This is a picture of an operating room in a Nagasaki hospital. This is a picture of the railway station in Hiroshima. What are the implications of all this for Nanuse Bay and Nanaimo? Those of you who love Nanaimo may be very happy to know that it's probably not large enough to warrant a nuclear weapon being targeted on it. I don't know if there is a target on Nanuse Bay. If it were, and if it were released, we can be very sure that those targeted on the rest of our West Coast and probably in all of North America would also be released. Does the fact that there are only a few people around Nanuse Bay and that Nanaimo would not be directly hit by a nuclear bomb make it safer to live here? What about the fallout that I spoke of? Perhaps we should hope that if a strike comes, it comes in winter so that the prevailing winds are away from Nanaimo. Is the water reservoir at Lanceville assured of being intact and the water lines uninterrupted? What about the wells, which depend upon electricity for the pumps? Even if power lines and the main source of electricity were intact, the electromagnetic pulse, which would likely be generated by thousands of nuclear weapons being exploded, would make those useless. The 368 beds in your hospital could all be intact and the doctors and nurses safe. Of what value would those be for the burn victims to be transported to the four beds in Victoria? Or if our airstrip was intact here, would that help us get them to Vancouver when there would undoubtedly, the airfield there would be targeted? There are 19 burn beds in the Vancouver General Hospital, the only burn beds in all the Lower Mainland. And does it give reassurance to know the Provincial Emergency Coordination Center is located here? A fallout shelter from which the government will, and I quote from their material, the government will be equipped with the necessary communication facilities to maintain contact between the various parts of the community. The assumptions on which those plans are based make very interesting reading. If you haven't been prudent enough to stock your house with facilities and supplies, they guarantee you of 30 days in which to get supplies. Will the milk be safe to drink from the cows that are fed upon the contaminated grass? Supposing you and the officials both survive with no major injuries or illnesses, could this city, Could this island become self-sufficient? You who plant gardens, are you assured of a bumper crop next year, or perhaps you need to order from your seed catalog still? Perhaps nuclear winter will affect only the interior of our country and the coast may be saved. Do we still need grain from the prairies? What will happen when our present stocks of antibiotics and other life-saving drugs are depleted? Are you or a friend a diabetic? All those questions and answers hinge on the one inescapable fact. Peoples of the industrial world, like it or not, have become inextricably interdependent. There is no place to hide. My own particular interest has always been in the psychosocial effects of nuclear weapons and nuclear war, and that's another entire topic. Suffice it to say that our future depends entirely upon our present psychological health. Recounting the doom and gloom as I have may sound like no way to promote psychological health, but before we can avert danger, we must know that it exists. That is healthy. That has been the goal towards which Physicians for Social Responsibility has reached. We know the goal is still incomplete, but we also know we must now direct our energies toward the other aspect of medicine, namely healing. Each one of us must participate in that healing process. You may believe there is nothing you can do to help. Before I close, I would like you to stretch your imagination to see yourself walking through the forest in this area on a winter's day with the gentle snow falling all around you. You are caught by the beauty of each snowflake as it rests on your outstretched hand for a moment before melting into nothingness. Suddenly, there is a resounding crash, and you look around to find that a huge branch has been torn from the largest tree in the forest. Which snowflake did it? Each one of us is as unique, as insignificant, and as powerful as a snowflake. Another Japanese graphic artist, Kamuko, eloquently portrays the hope and faith he places in each individual. His poster is entitled, "You are a remarkable magician because peace is concealed in your hand." Let us learn to tread more softly on this earth. Let us learn to deal more gently with ourselves and with one another, no matter who the other may be. Let us learn to release the magic in our hands.
I'd like to thank Dr. Goreski for a brilliant and a very, very moving presentation. We have time for about 7 minutes of questions before the coffee break, if any of you would like to ask Dr. Goreski some questions. Rosalie?
Yes. I'd like to move back a little bit from the megaton blast and talk about something like a reactor accident. And I was at the meeting of the separate school board in Toronto last June when they announced the first evacuation plan for around the Pickering nuclear plant. It seems there's some 6,000 children in school there, and they received a letter from the police department telling them the school's responsibility for evacuation in case of a problem at the plant. And there were two things that they said that, it was shocking just to get this letter from the police department. One was that in case of an accident, the school was to immediately administer potassium iodide to the children. Now, the school had a policy of giving no medicine whatsoever to children, even an aspirin. So this was directly counter to school policy. The second thing that they were being told by the police department is that they were responsible to have a personal file for each child in the school saying where to take them in case of emergency. And, you know, you think of 6,000 children, you know, take Susie to her aunt's, and if she isn't home, take her to her grandmother's. I mean, that's all I could think of. But could you back away to these other very real problems?
These are problems which, because we become centered and concerned, as PSR has in looking at the ultimate issue, that we do not take time to examine these things. And it has been a question of which should be looking at what the physicians should be ready to do in the event of nuclear accidents. It is an area that I haven't looked at broadly, Dr. Bertel. I think the part that I respond to, and because my whole orientation in this area has been the psychological aspects, I think the psychological damage that is happening to these children is something that we need to look at so very, very carefully. And the children, interestingly enough, recognize the incongruity of something like this much more rapidly than adults do. I'm digressing somewhat from Dr. Bertel's question, but apparently when the civil defense plans were brought to the schools in the United States, the children laughed the planners out of their school. They saw the nonsense behind it. Dr. Bertel, do you have some responses that you would like to make, because this is an area you have studied so much more?
Well, I'm concerned about things like replacement therapy, so I don't know whether the people in this area, for example, know about potassium iodide or have any available to them. The other replacement, that replaces iodine, puts normal iodine in the thyroid so you don't pick up radioactive iodine, at least at the same rate. The other replacement is vitamin B12, where you put normal cobalt in the liver instead of picking up cobalt 60, which is a terrible gamma emitter, very strong gamma emitter. My sense is people have never even been told these things. There's no preparation for it. When they had the Three Mile Island accident, they didn't even have any potassium iodide in the area. And the East Coast lab stayed up 24 hours trying to produce it. Eventually, they sent it in liquid form, and they sent in eyedroppers, which didn't fit the bottles. And it was over a week later before they got their act together, and by that time, it was too late for replacement.
I apologize to the people at the mic. We're only going to have time for two of you, and then we'll have to go on with the rest of the schedule. So after the first two, I think the rest of you should probably take your seats. So first question.
Kenneth McAllister, World Federalists of Canada, Judicial Action Committee. I want to commend Dr. Gresky's description of the effects on people of this weapon. But I've been looking over our program, and I find it singularly lacking in identifying or proposing to identify the people who are causing war. In the peace conference at The Hague in 1899, the peace people met and demanded that the governments stop war. The governments refused. In 1899, they set us up for two world wars and a lot of other wars. Now, at this point, where we have this horrible destructive weapon in the hands of military and psychopathic people who are motivated to kill, I recommend that the committee allow time in the remaining part of your program for considering the criminal aspects of deploying a nuclear weapon, which is part of an agenda to kill hundreds of millions of people. This is not a laboratory problem. This is a human and criminal problem. The rule of law in the world is on the doorstep for survival. If we don't have the rule of law, if we don't force these criminals to stop deploying these weapons, there's no point in having any meetings on peace.
I will ask the executive. I will ask the executive to consider your comments at their luncheon meeting today and to see if they wish to amend the balance of the program after lunch. Did you wish to respond to that?
Yes, I would like to respond to that. And it's again in a very indirect way. Simply recognizing that if we can begin to comprehend the reasons why the military, why the politicians, who are not necessarily insane people by any means, the reasons why they continue to do what they're doing, our comprehension of that will enable us to understand that and to maybe make a dialogue, to engage in dialogue with these people so they begin to understand where we come from and begin to make those moves that Einstein recognized had to be made, that with the atomic weapon, everything had changed save our mode of thinking. These people are still caught in the old mode of thinking, and there needs to be assistance and help in realizing how we can make that change.
All right. Last question.
My name's Alistair Haythornthwaite. I'm from Duncan. And I wanted to say that I feel that this concentration on the terrors of a nuclear attack in a lot of ways is going to hurt our ability to deal with the danger of war. Because the truth of the matter is, if you're under conventional attack, if you were in Hanoi being bombed, or if you are hit by a cluster bomb, you're going to be just as dead and probably in just as great a numbers as if there's a nuclear attack. And it's my feeling that the big powers use their nuclear arsenals to terrorize the world. They threaten every country and every people, and even in some countries their internal population, that if we do not toe the line, they will unleash this terror on us. And now Reagan has come forward, and he is the great savior, because he says, yes, nuclear war is terrifying, and so we have Star Wars. So in that way, he's exploited the terror created about nuclear weapons. Now, my feeling is that all war kills people, and conventional or nuclear, it's not good to distinguish between the two. And I just think that we should be looking for ways to unite people, not terrorize them, and leave them passive and shell-shocked so that we can deal with this the threat from the two superpowers.
All right, thank you. Dr. Goreski, do you wish to respond to that?
I'm not sure that there is a very brief response that can be made to that. It involves the whole psychological area, which is a very important one.
Do any of the panelists wish to respond to any of the session? Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Goreski, for an excellent presentation. I've been asked to make this announcement before the coffee break, and by the way, the coffee break will be just as it says. We're going to start very promptly at 11:15, so if you wouldn't mind, please being back in your seats by 11:15. And the brief announcement is with reference to the attempt by the regional district of Nanaimo and CIP Industries to evict the Nanoose Peace Camp. Two petitions have been drafted. They read as follows. To the chairperson and members of the Nanaimo Regional Board, the peace camp on lands owned by CIP is a nonviolent statement of the Nanoose conversion campaign in an open and democratic society. Whether or not you agree with this statement, we urge you to reconsider your motion requiring that the peace camp be dismantled. And to the management of CIP Industries, the peace camp on your lands is a nonviolent statement of the Nanoose conversion campaign in an open and democratic society. Your gesture in allowing it is greatly appreciated. We urge you to resist any pressure to demand that the site be evacuated. Now, apparently these two petitions will be at the table at the back of the room, and you are apparently urged, all of you, to sign both of them. See you at 11:15.